This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. As we speak, a group of wild and reckless men, women, and dogs are facing dangerous storms, bitter cold, and mind-blowing solitude in the wilds of Alaska. Last Saturday, the Iditarod began. It's a 1,200-mile sled dog race which runs from Anchorage to Nome. In 1983 and again in 1985, Gary Paulson ran the race. And what a ride it was. He writes in his new book, Winter Dance, "I knew nothing of Alaska, crossing mountain ranges, running on sea ice, 1,180 miles of snow and deep cold, cold like I had never even imagined, winds beyond belief, roaring waters and deadly dreams, a world, a whole world beyond my knowing." Paulson is well known to young readers for his many books about adventure and survival. He's won the Newbery Honor Award for Children's Literature 3 times for Dog Song, Hatchet, and Winter Room. Recently, he's been writing books for adults. Last year, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon told of his troubled childhood with alcoholic parents. And this year's Winter Dance is about his first Iditarod. At one point, Paulson had as many as 91 dogs. I asked him what made him decide to run the race.
It was not sane. I had been completely shattered financially. My wife and I went broke in Colorado, and we went to Minnesota to live in the woods and live off the land, and I started trapping for the state and for myself. I mean, it was a job. And Minnesota had a law that said you couldn't use a four-wheeler or a snow machine for trapping, so I was on foot. We didn't have a car. But somebody also knew that there was a statement in the law that says you could use a dog team. So somebody had heard about me. They gave me 4 older dogs and a busted sled, which I fixed up. And I started using them for transportation. In fact, I got an Army training manual called Transportation, Dog, 1 each. And honest to God, and it was invaluable. It's just, it's a great book for anybody who's thinking about dogs. It tells you, I mean, how to take care of them and how to do things, is when to water them. I mean, just basics, you know, that a lot of people don't know.
When you were out running with these dogs and trapping and working together, was that when the idea of the Iditarod came to you?
What happened was I came off a long run. I'd been on the trap line, and I'd quit trapping because I decided that it was not correct to kill animals, and I'm not going to get into a big controversial thing, but for me, it's not the right thing to do. I'm a vegetarian now. And I had quit that, and I had not told anybody that I'd quit trapping because I loved running dogs so much. And I was on a long run. It was a almost an 8-day run. And as I was coming home off this run, I crossed a lake in the moonlight. It was about 30 below. It was midnight. Beautiful full moon. And when dogs run, they're silent. They never make a sound. And as I crossed the lake, at the end of the lake, I went up through these trees, and their breath inverted and came over their backs, the steam. And it hid the dogs, and it was like I was being pulled by this silent steam ghost through the moonlight. God, it was beautiful. And at the top of this hill, there was a fork, and if I'd taken the trail straight home, it would have been about 2 hours, and I'd have been home with noise and people and everything. And if I took a right, I'd see it again, and I saw I hung a right, and I ran 5 or 6 days, 7 days. When I came off the run, somebody told me about the race, and I thought that the Iditarod must be the maximum expression of that beauty, that running the dogs 1,180 miles, well, I thought it was 1049 then, but it turned out to be 1180, running them 1,180 miles would all be beautiful, and by God, it was. I mean, I ran it twice, and it was all beautiful both times.
Now, I assume in assembling a dog team, personality plays a big part in it, about who's going to be the leader, who's going to follow the leader. How complicated is it to put together a team of dogs?
The first team that I ever ran when I was trapping, I didn't have a leader, and I tied a rope around my waist, and I was the leader, and I left the yard pulling these 4 dogs in the sled, and I thought, this is really stupid. It didn't accomplish anything. You know, I was still out in front of them somewhere. But then I found out one of the dogs wanted to lead. You could tell that this dog named Bea kept looking ahead, trying to get to over the next hill, and that's what a leader does. It wants to get out there and see what's ahead. And they don't all want to lead. Some of them would rather just run in the team. But the ones who want to lead will actually stand when you're stopped and jump up and try to see over the next hill, over the next rise. They'll actually try and see ahead. And you keep moving dogs forward till the leaders kind of select themselves. It's not a social thing. It's not the pack structure and all of that. That's Jack London was, I don't think he ran dogs very much.
Well, when you're with doing the Iditarod or with a team of dogs, who's the boss, you or the lead dog?
It depends on how you look at it. It's a shared responsibility. An interesting situation develops in that the person can think they're in charge, but the truth is that dog out in front can kill you. Has to know where to go to avoid bad ice and to handle situations that occur before the human gets there. So the dog really, the lead dogs are really kind of the bosses. And it's all a shared thing. It's very friendly and all that. It's not a competitive thing. But I learned finally that when I made a decision to do something, it was almost invariably wrong and we would get lost. And if I allowed Cookie, who was my leader in my first race, the primary leader, if I allowed her to make the decision, we were almost always right. And so I finally shut up and let Cookie run the show, and she took me to Nome.
How did you communicate with your dogs? Did you ever develop a kind of a growling that they understood?
Yeah, you get to where you can growl at them. I'm not sure that... Yeah, you do. I mean, you can stop a fight sometimes. If a couple of dogs start fighting, you can growl really just... Wah! And they'll stop the fight. They know that you're interested in what they're doing. But you communicate in language. Cookie knew three names. She had a nickname of Ducks, and at one point I said, "What's up, Ducks?" And her tail wagged, so I started calling her Ducks. And then Mama. She had good pups, and she was a good mother, so I called her Mama, and she would wag her tail. She knew that she had three names. And you could communicate, and in her case, if I wanted to go right, I would say G or left was ha, which is the standard terms. But if I said G a little, she'd go about 18 inches over.
Really?
Yeah. So I could go G a little, ha a little, G a little, ha a little, and go through a room full of furniture with her. She knew exactly what my voice meant when I did those things. She knew me better, I think, than probably anybody ever has.
Anybody, including your wife?
Yes. Yeah, I spent 16,000 or 17,000 miles with her, with Ducks, before she got a little arthritis, and then I retired and brought her in the house, and she would sit next to me all the time in the house. Mm-hmm. After she retired, if we were watching television, she'd sit on the couch next to me and not allow other people to sit there.
Hmm. Well, when you're training dogs for the Iditarod, do you bring them in the house? Do you give them special treats? Do you snuggle with them and do all the things that most families do with a family pet? Or is there something different you have to do?
I would not normally want them in the house because it's better for them to grow their hair if they're outside more. But I would go out and sleep in the kennel with them frequently. Sometimes when it was a warm day in the summer and everybody was just kind of lazy, I'd let them all go. Hmm. And they'd all run to the house, and we'd bring 8 or 10 in the house at a time or whatever. We'd have to hide the cats first because they kept eating the cats. It's not good for house cats.
You mean literally eating the cats?
They would eat them if they caught them, yeah. Yeah, they didn't have they don't know the rules. They don't know that if a cat arches its back and hisses that it means something. They just go ahead and eat it. So you have to be very careful about that.
You write about having some trouble, at least in the beginning stages of training your dogs, and you decided to sleep in the kennel with them. Actually, I think you had been sprayed by a skunk, and your wife suggested that you both, that you sleep in the kennel. But how did that change your relationship with them to sleep together?
Well, it was more than sleeping. It was the concept of becoming dog. If you want to learn, I mean, there's no substitute for personal inspection at zero altitude in life, really. That's the best possible way to learn something. And the idea of finding out what a dog is like and how they live and how they think, for instance, they have houses. Each dog has a house and his own little kennel. And you would be amazed at how little they go in that house. They sit out in the rain. They love rain. Hmm. And it never penetrates. So they would sit out in the rain. And they don't understand why you don't want to be in the rain. If it's rainy, it doesn't bother them. Well, then why would you have to go to the house? So I would just put on rain gear then and stay out there with them and work and do things. And they finally become part of how you think, and And I think you become part of how they think.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Gary Paulson. For many years, he's been writing books for children, and his latest book is called Winter Dance, and it's about the time he ran the Iditarod in Alaska, and he did it twice in 1983 and again in 1985. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Gary Paulson about his experiences running the Iditarod in Alaska. So how did you prepare yourself for this 1,200-mile run? I mean, are there books written about how to survive the Iditarod?
I don't think, no. At the time, I called two different people. One of them told me to wear mukluks and then hung up.
What are mukluks?
Mukluks is the kind of footgear that keeps your feet warm, but that's all he told me. This is a man who had run the race. He says, yeah, you better wear mukluks, and click, that was it. And the other guy I called who had run the race said, get good dogs. I mean, that's it. And that was my sum total of advice. I then started just trying to glean whatever I could anywhere. There are books, I think, now from people who and pamphlets and stuff from people who run, but in 83, when I ran my first race, a lot of that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Now you have to have qualifying races, too. But then you didn't have to. You could just go run in fact, the first race I ever ran was the Iditarod.
Well, the race begins in Anchorage and ends in Nome. And you were voted least likely to get out of Anchorage. And I'd love to have you tell us what the start of the race looked like for you, what the observers saw.
I drew position number 32 to leave the chutes, and I had never been in a race, so I had a trapline leader named Cookie, who was a wonderful leader, but she'd never been in a race either. So I decided somebody had given me a dog named Wilson, who was a sweet dog, but not inordinately intelligent. And they had said he was a race leader, so I put him on in the front just because I thought he would be good. And he got us out of the chutes, great, but you go four blocks and then you turn right and you kind of weave through town to get out. And he just blew a hole through the crowd, and we didn't even try the turn. I mean, he just was going everywhere, and I was going, I saw way more of Anchorage than most mushers see. I was wandering around. I'd have to ask people where the Iditarod Trail was, this full dog team with all my gear on it. God, it was just embarrassing.
Were you in control in any way of your team of dogs?
No, not at all. I couldn't stop them. I couldn't slow them down. Wilson was just going ape. He had a great time, and we went through people's yards and stuff. It was just awful. And finally, I hooked a stop sign. And got the sled stopped, and then I put Cookie back in the front end, and I had really good control with her, and she got us out of town okay.
You say the race is about caring for the dogs. What do they need, and how do you take care of them in this, 17, 18, 19, 20-day run?
You take constant care of their feet. You rub ointment in their feet every chance you get. Different types of, like Vaseline is one of the good ones. And then you put booties on them so that their feet don't get sore, depending on the dog. Some dogs don't need booties. Many do. You feed them. In my case, I fed almost every 40 minutes, literally. And so I would go up the line and snack them every 40 minutes. And then you watch them, and if they get even a little tired, you stop and rest them. I mean, it's just this constant. I've talked to guys who have run that whole race and never looked at the scenery. And never seen anything but their dogs. They never look up. They just watch their dogs all the time taking care of them.
When do you begin to lose track of time when you're running the Iditarod?
Probably by the second or third day. You don't sleep normally. In fact, the Iditarod is an altering experience. You never sleep normally again.
Really?
I still don't. Yeah,
And this is
don't.
10 years later.
Yeah, I don't sleep more than 4 hours a night. I still don't. And when I wake up, I listen for my dogs. By the second or third day, usually you're out of touch with what the world is, and you're only in touch with the dogs and what you're trying to do.
Were you able to take in the terrain, or were you busy watching your dogs?
My first race, I took uh, I carried a camera because I had a lot of sponsors that never believed I would get there, and they were really sweet people. And so I took 750 slides going across, but most of them are no good because I was being dragged on my face or falling off cliffs and stuff. But anyway, I wound up with about 80 slides and that are really pretty, and there's about 20 of them in the book, as a matter of fact. I put some in the book. But generally, you don't look at anything but dogs. You really don't. A lot of the pictures I took, I just hold the camera up and I didn't even look through it. I click it and hope that something was on there.
Were you able to get little cat naps?
You rest, but you kind of do it with your eyes open. You rest, your body goes into a rest state sometimes, but you don't really sleep. It's not a normal type sleep. You don't get REM sleep ever, I don't think, in the race.
When did the hallucinations start?
In my case, they start the third night, perhaps earlier in the second night, but I think it was the third night. And they were very involved. I had guys riding on my sled. I would talk to them. People, I would see naked women. I had, at one point, a whole village I was in, and people waving at me and telling me to let the dogs go. They'd catch them. And God, I was so glad. It was like a checkpoint. And it was all in my head. All in my head. And I think the hallucinations don't ever end. It's just that in 85, I learned to control them a little so that I would kind of know that it was a hallucination, but I'd go ahead and have it anyway.
But you had a little, in 85, there was a voice that said, here they come again. Here come those hallucinations.
Yeah, you would say, well, here's one, and somebody would be sitting on your sled talking to you. Hmm. And so I would kind of talk to him and I knew it was insane, but it kind of got me through the moment. I've talked to people who have let their sleds go, thinking that somebody was there to catch them and stuff.
So hallucinations are pretty common then during the Iditarod.
Oh, everybody. I mean, everybody that I know have spoken to has had them. And they even the people who have won the race many times still, I think, have them at night. In my case, it was between midnight and 3 or 4 in the morning, somewhere in there, sometimes up to 5 in the morning, was the worst time.
Gary Paulson is my guest, and we're talking about his running of the Iditarod, which he did back in the 80s, and he's written a book about it called Winter Dance. When you got close to the end of the race, did your mind change? I mean, did you feel somehow, or your mood change, realizing that you were going to make it?
No. When I was about 25 miles out, you run on a beach the last 40 miles. And I got in late at night. I got in at 9:30, so it was dark. And I could see the lights hours before I got there. I could see Nome. And lights you don't see in the race. You just never see lights. It's something we're not used to down here. But up in Alaska, the whole interior is not lighted. And so you're so used to darkness that when you see all these lights in the distance, it just seems so... seemed like a major city. I think Nome's got 3,000 people. It just seemed like, God, it was New York up there. And I didn't want to go in. I didn't want to be with people.
Why not?
I'd found a kind of solitude and beauty. And I still have some of that, by God. I really do.
You got into Nome?
I stopped about 20 miles out. I stopped and, 18 miles maybe or something. I stopped and I stood there looking. I decided I'd go back. I decided I'd just not go in. And there was another man running near me, and he stopped and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'll turn around." And he said, "No, you got to finish. You don't get your buckle," he says, "unless you finish." You get a belt buckle, you know. And I think maybe that was one of the things. I thought, well, I ought to get my buckle, you know. So, I mean, you have to understand, my mind was completely fried by this time. I was just gone. But a lot of that that wishing for solitude still exists in me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm out here in California right now restoring a sailboat that I'll probably do some solitude on.
So when you got into Nome in the middle of the night, anyone there to cheer you across the finish line?
Yes, my wife and son were there, and they had flown up, and Cookie didn't want it. We got to 12 feet from the finish line, and there was a big crowd there and people yelling and stuff, so she stopped. And then she sat...
She had the same feeling you had, right?
Yeah, she just sat down, and so I went up and helped her get... I grabbed her harness, and we went across together. And then somebody took my dogs, and you have to understand during the race, nobody touches your dogs. I mean, that's just never, you just don't do that. And they have these mushers, Iditarod mushers, who take your dogs because you can't think right. And they put your dogs on beds and your handler's there, you know, taking care of things. So all this was going on. And I turned away. When I turned back, the dogs were gone. Hmm. And there was a man right in my face. And he said, welcome to Nome or something. And I said, where's my dogs? And he said, don't worry about you. I said, I want my dogs now. And I was going to hit him. It was the mayor of Nome, Leo Rasmussen, welcoming me to Nome. I was just completely gone. My wife came up really quick. She was standing there, and she said, Ruth said, it's okay, it's okay. It's okay, we'll go to the dogs. So she took me down to the dogs. And I crawled around in the straw with them, petting them and thanking them for the run. And she stood with her hand on my head crying because she thought I was permanently insane. and actually, I probably was. I mean, it's an altering experience.
Well, you end your book with another chapter in your life. You were in Boston and looked like you had a heart attack or something close to that. And you were told that you'd have to live a, quote, more normal life and you'd have to give up the dogs.
God, that was rough.
You also write, how can I live without my dogs? Do you live without your dogs now?
I had a friend named Mark Nordman who came and got him. And he got it all. I mean, he got the sleds, everything. And it was nice that he did. But I'll give you an idea how strong this pull is. Last year, I went up to northern Minnesota and ran dogs again to see if I could. And about 5 weeks ago, I went up to Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, and ran dogs.
Do you get the same feeling at all from riding that you get from running with your dogs?
I do. I love writing in many ways similar to how I love the dogs. I love writing the way you love, so that when I'm working on a story, if it's working right, the hair goes up on my neck. It's very exciting. And I work as hard at writing as I did with dogs, too.
The subtitle of your book is The Fine Madness of Running the Iditarod. Do you like losing your mind?
I think it's wonderful to push the limits, to push the boundary of the performance envelope or whatever. I think there's a great beauty in that artistically. I don't think completely losing it is a good thing, but to get on that edge when you're working in the arts, I think is very important, and to function on that edge, I think it's vital, and I think there's not many people doing it now.
Well, Gary Paulson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful being here.
Gary Paulson's book about running the Iditarod in 1983 is called Winter Dance. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.